just because you give more money to the schools and teachers, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to, that the kids are going to learn more.
A likely dead end for the governor's scholarship program in the legislature this year. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 30th of March. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state says goodbye to prison businesses.
It has produced little to no profits whatsoever. In fact, it's run in the deficit mode the last few years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Lawmakers aren't likely to approve Governor Sean Parnell's scholarship program this year. They're still looking for money to pay for the plan. The State Finance Committee tomorrow will take a look at what was originally proposed as a $400 million endowment to help pay university costs for students who qualify. But Senate President Gary Stevens says the price tag has long been seen as a problem. And while setting the whole endowment aside is asking a lot, there are several other options available.
Now it's in the hands of finance where it really needs to be. The bill is in good shape, and the only issue is how do you pay for it. So finance now has all of the education bills, and they're going to be looking at all of the issues out there. But whether they're going to be able to come to a decision during this session or not is sort of questionable to me.
Stevens says the cost of the final scholarship program has changed since the governor introduced it, and it might require some legislative activity during the interim to determine the financing plan. That would leave final action on the program for the next legislature in 2011. Homer Republican Paul Seaton chairs the House Education Committee that rewrote and added several elements to the governor's original bill. He says members began looking for alternatives as they came to realize that the $400 million in funding, as he put it, hit a brick wall.
We've got students that are going to take classes, work for grades, get a scholarship, and expect that to be there for basically 4 years. And so we need some mechanism so that even if we decide to change in the future, we'll meet those obligations that have been incurred.
Anchorage Republican Kevin Meyer chaired the Senate Education Committee hearing on the program. He says the House and Senate committees have worked well with the administration, but the price has nearly doubled since the bill was originally introduced. Meyer says the result is a good program that would get students involved by taking harder classes and getting better grades. He says the option his committee rejected was simply giving more money to the schools.
Just because you give more money to the schools and teachers, that doesn't necessarily mean that the kids are going to learn more. I truly believe that the key is to get the parents involved and to get the kids motivated. And I think this scholarship program that we put together in conjunction with the governor's commissioner was going to do that.
The program was designed to pay all tuition expenses for students who have taken basic levels of math, science, language arts, and social studies. Those with an A grade average would get 100% of the scholarship, with lesser amounts for lower grade averages. The Alaska Department of Corrections is closing the last of the state's prison industries. A garment shop and a furniture factory shut down on Wednesday. An industrial laundry closes in September. The programs train and hire inmates, pay them a small wage, and teach a work ethic they'll need when they are released from prison. Corrections Department officials say there will be future training programs, but it may be months before something else is in place. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports in this first story of a three-part series.
When Tyler Powell was incarcerated in 2004, he wanted a job. He heard about the garment shop at Metal Creek Correctional Center in Eagle River and applied, but he was at Wildwood Prison in Kenai.
A couple weeks later, I was transferred and started working.
Powell learned how to sew and made everything from prison uniforms to chef coats and sheets for the Alaska Marine Highway System. Powell also worked on projects for businesses outside the prison. Little League windbreakers, pants, furniture covers, and upholstery. he learned how to repair the industrial sewing machines the inmates used.
It was very steady employment. You know, we got 8 hours a day most days, 40 hours a week most weeks. We got the state holidays off without pay, and when there's institutional things going on, they would close us down.
Created in statute in 1981, Alaska Correctional Industries grew to 8 separate factories or repair shops throughout the state's prison system, including a sewing division, auto body repair, metal fabrication, a slaughterhouse and meat processing facility, as well as 2 furniture factories that used Alaska birch. Wally Roman was the first ACI general manager.
There were small mom-and-pop businesses that sprang up because of that, local kilns and that type of thing that were doing business with us. To some extent, we created more of a business environment or more business activity within the state.
Roman says ACI was run like a business in those years. 2 showrooms, product marketing, contracts with state of Alaska agencies as well as the private sector. Sales and state general funds paid for the operation. In 2006, ACI was changed to the Prisoner Employment Program to be totally self-sufficient through revenues generated by production. 5 of 8 programs were closed, leaving only a furniture factory at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward, sewing at Highland Mountain Women's Prison in Eagle River, and the laundry at Lemon Creek Correctional Center in Juneau. Over the years, a sewing division alone has trained more than 1,000 adult offenders. But Corrections Department Administrative Services Director Leslie Houston says the garment factory is not making any money.
They have produced a large number of items, but it's also a very high overhead industry, and it has produced little to no profits whatsoever. In fact, it's run in the deficit mode the last few years.
Houston says the Spring Creek Furniture Factory barely breaks even.
With the furniture industry, there's a saturation point, plus delivering from Seward into South Central Alaska, you know, increases the cost, and then it makes it somewhat prohibitive. And of course, we always have to be very, very cautious that we do not compete with the private sector.
In his 17 years with ACI, Roman doesn't recall conflicts with the private sector. He believes the industries would be more efficient if the operation had maintained a business structure.
When they got rid of the correctional industries legislation, they shut down both showrooms in Anchorage and Juneau, took away the marketing program, the operations program, got rid of the general manager, and put the 2 remaining industries under the superintendents. Superintendents know a lot about security. They don't know much about private business.
For the last couple of years, Eddie Ezel of Wasilla has been using Highland Mountain inmates to make his Alaska-designed parkas, an Eskimo-style summer jacket. He says the inmates' work has been consistently high quality, reasonably priced, and his parkas are Alaska-made.
You know, the state of Alaska wants everyone to buy Alaskan and be Alaskan and produce Alaskan. Here I am trying to get started with something like that. It seems foolish to me that all of a sudden now the state is sending all this money outside.
Ezel thought contracting with the Highland Prison would allow him to grow his business.
My goal was to eventually build a manufacturing plant here in the valley that when these people come out of prison, they're already trained for me. You know, they've already got the job skills that I need.
That's how former inmate Tyler Powell got his current job in an Anchorage upholstery and canopy business. When he was released from prison in 2007, he was offered work based on projects he'd successfully completed in ACI.
I enjoy my current job a lot. I've never imagined going into this kind of an industry. And because of the ACI program, I learned a skill that I never would have learned before.
Correction Department officials say only the Lemon Creek Laundry keeps the prisoner employment programs afloat. It does all the laundry for the state ferries that operate in southeast Alaska, but it's slated to close in September. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding beauty in the things we usually call junk.
Old stuff, cars, boats, cabins, all that stuff that's hard to throw away.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Researchers are trying to figure out how stellar sea lions react to changes in their diets. The information might help scientists understand the population decline in the wild. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with one of the lead researchers.
Scientists with the Marine Mammal Research Consortium in British Columbia manipulated the diets of 8 female stellar sea lions for 1 month in the summer and 1 month in the winter. Each of the sea lions received 80% of their normal energetic food intake, but one group was given herring, a fatty fish, and the other was given pollock, a significantly less fatty fish. The group that ate herring had 80% of their normal daily herring intake. The group that ate pollock had almost twice as much biomass of fish as normal, but they were eating pollock instead of herring. Lead scientist Tiffin Jenya Duda said they wanted to see how the sea lions used the energy they consumed.
How would they decide to partition their energy budget when they don't get enough energy for everything?
Both groups of sea lions lost the same amount of weight, but from different parts of their bodies. The sea lions that ate pollock lost muscle mass, which over time could cause them to lose organ functions. The animals that ate the fattier, healthier fish were better able to adjust to the loss of energy and use what they had appropriately.
The animals fed herring, they mostly decreased their activity level to spare energy and also tried to preserve as much as possible their lipid reserve from their blubber layer, their insulative layer, while the animal fed pollock didn't adjust as well as all these environmental conditions.
Jenya says that what they eat, even though they're getting the same number of calories, affects how they use the energy.
So it seems that if they are on a bad diet or a low-quality diet, they may not be able to adjust to environment as well.
The theory is that the different foods are triggering different hormonal reactions. The internal systems of the sea lions that are eating pollock are confused. Their bellies are full, but they don't get enough energy to function like normal. Jenya says researchers are still gathering data on exactly what sea lions eat in the wild, but samples of scat collected during summer research seasons indicate that they're eating low-energy pollock because that's what's mostly available.
The reason why we think they might have a food shortage in the North Pacific Ocean is that because there is a great increase in the pollock populations in this area. So we think that sea lions are eating mostly pollock, especially in winter.
That preliminary information, combined with the study on the captive sea lions, which shows that sea lions' bodies don't adapt as well when eating pollock, might be a clue as to why sea lion populations aren't doing as well in the North Pacific. However, researchers are still doing more studies. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Sea Alaska will distribute almost $8 million to shareholders this month. The Southeast Regional Native Corporation has about 20,000 tribal members, more than half of them living outside the region. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Shareholders will receive dividends ranging from about $230 to around $650 each. The amount depends on shareholder status, age, and membership in smaller native corporations. Payments will start April 9th. The last few distributions reflected large investment losses and slowed business earnings, but they were boosted by mining and oil income shared by other regional native corporations. Sea Alaska spokesman Todd Antioquia says the April payout is a different story.
In 2009, we had a number of success stories, both in our manufacturing and services divisions. Not only that, but the financial markets actually performed well throughout the year. And, of course, natural resource development continues to play a real vital role, you know, both for Sea Alaska and for the Southeast economies.
Full earnings details will be released in the corporation's annual report, which will be out mid-May. Andy Oquia says initial information shows timber earnings continue to be strong, though they're shrinking as Sea Alaska runs out of loggable land. But an out-of-state plastics design and manufacturing partnership called Nipro Canuck is growing.
We have operations in Iowa, Alabama, and Mexico. And they continue to build an excellent client base and really have not only are contributing, you know, possibly today, but really they have a very bright future, too, in the sectors that they've been developing.
About three-quarters of Sea Alaska's 20,000 shareholders will get dividends of $412 each. Those members are also enrolled in an urban native corporation, such as Juneau's Gold Belt or Sitka's Sciatica. Or they're at-large shareholders, those who are not enrolled in any village or urban corporation. The other quarter of the shareholders will get dividends of $236. Those are mostly members of village corporations such as Saxman's Cape Fox or Yakutat's Yaktat Kwan. Also included are new shareholders enrolled after a vote to extend stock to original shareholders' descendants. Andy Oquia says the difference between the payout amounts is the natural resource earnings pool named for Section 7J of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
Sea Alaska, under ANCSA, pays directly to their respective village corporations the 7J payment, and many of those village corporations do pass through that amount onto their shareholders, but it's in accordance to their own policies.
Most shareholders 65 and older will get an additional $236 payment each. That's due to a new elder stock provision approved by shareholders last year. About 2,000 older shareholders have opted into that program. Their total payments will be $648 for urban and at-large members and $472 for village members. Overall, Sea Alaska estimates about $3.7 million will be paid to shareholders living in Southeast. Another $4 million or so will go to those living elsewhere in Alaska or the lower 48. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
This winter's well below normal snowfall could help reduce flooding during breakup. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says runoff from snowmelt is one of the factors that affects spring flood potential.
This year, with less snow on the ground and less water to go in the rivers, there's a better chance that the breakup will not be as severe.
The National Weather Service has measured just 24.8 inches of snow at Fairbanks' international airport this winter. That's about 40 inches below normal and the third lowest season snow total on record in over 100 years. The low snow totals are consistent across the interior. While minimal snow means less water runoff, Plum says it makes for thicker ice.
With less snowfall, there's less insulating snowpack on the ice. And we measure ice thicknesses around the first of each month through the winter. And most sites are at normal or slightly thicker than normal, and that is probably due to less snowfall.
Thicker ice can mean more ice jam potential during breakup, but Plum says springtime weather will be the deciding factor in what happens.
The real trigger to breakup is actually the temperatures. So if we have a spring where the temperature goes above freezing during the day and you know, we get some snow melt, so the snow basically kind of bleeds off during the day, but then it refreezes at night. So when the river does fill up with water and the ice starts to move, the ice tends to be in a more weakened state, and we get more of like what we call a mush out.
Plum says a rapid warm-up leads to snow melt rushing into rivers. The fracture of strong ice, jams, and severe flooding, like what happened last spring in Eagle and some other river communities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Wasilla consumers will be paying less in sales taxes come this summer. A 1/2 percentage point cut takes effect in July. The reduction comes about a year early, since city voters raised their sales tax by 0.5% in 2002 to pay for the Wasilla Sports Complex. According to city officials, the last payment on the complex, now called the Kurt Menard Senior Sports Center, will be made early next year. Wasilla Mayor Vern Ruprecht.
The agreement with the taxpayers was that once the bond was discharged, then the 0.5 cent would be reduced back to 2 cents.
The city's sales tax reduction stands out as many communities across the nation wrestle with plans to raise taxes to cover deficits. That 0.5% in Wasilla brought in close to $3 million last year. Ruprecht says local consumers can help keep the city financially healthy by shopping there.
It's probably a good thing for government to say, listen, we'll consolidate what services we need to if we get into a real crunch, rather than go back to the taxpayers and demand anything else from them at this time.
Ruprecht says the Wasilla property tax of 2 mils is still on the books, but has been leveled to nothing by the city because Wasilla receives its operating revenue from the sales tax. Ruprecht says it is not likely the property tax will be revived anytime soon. As far as the sports complex itself, Ruprecht says it has cost the city money to run it. And with a recent change in management, the complex's uses are expanding, and the hope is in about a year it will be in the black. From now through mid-May, the Pratt Museum in Homer is featuring a special show that combines slices of Alaska history with the talents of two local artists to create a thought-provoking exhibit. KBBI's Marsha Lynn has more.
The materials used in the exhibit were found just lying around, says Asia Freeman.
Old stuff, cars, boats, cabins, all that stuff that's hard to throw away.
Freeman and her husband Michael Walsh created the show titled Backyard Alaska. She says Walsh first conceived of the idea while working with what she calls great gems of Alaska history in the form of films from Anchorage's Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association.
Snippets of these could be recast within these objects, like the window of a car, the window of a cabin. Look at stories or myths that are suggested by both the objects and the footage themselves to kind of raise the question of Alaska's kind of enigmatic and romantic power over the imagination that makes us hold on to these objects for so long.
11 years ago, Walsh bought a piece of land in the area complete with a junked car. He says it was his intention to become a homesteader, but the exhibit flows naturally from his futile efforts.
Didn't do anything on the land, and I just sold the land earlier in the year, but I ripped this car up for this exhibition, so I'm able to have captured something of this failed dream.
The exhibit's sound complements its content.
The ambient sound is coming from the doghouse, but it's meant to refer to the whole space, and it's classic backyard sounds. The bass line is Mossy Kilcher's beautiful Alaska songbird serenades. But we laid on top of that a barking dog who responds to a few gunshots, occasional falling tree, a saw, car pulling up, that kind of thing. Just a backyard situation.
Walsh and Freeman gave a guided tour of the exhibit during the opening reception last week. One stop was a rusty drum partially filled with water, leaves floating on top, and bright moving images emanating from beneath the surface.
Somebody told me some time ago that the state flower was a 55-gallon drum. For Alaska.
Oh.
And all the footage is stuff shot. This is all down at the harbor too on 16. It's all abstract, but sort of edited and shot in this concept of just fluid, even like a thick, oily something or another.
A large toy wooden airplane is another relic on display, accompanied by vintage World War II footage punctuated with music.
Seasons came and changed the time. When I grew up, I called him mine. He would always laugh and say, remember when we used to play, bang, bang.
Other backyard objects include an old cabin, polar bear hide, and half a rowboat, all with film, stories, and music to enhance their place in the gallery. Backyard Alaska is on display at the Pratt through May 16th. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
Nome, Alaska is noted as a historic gold rush town and as the final checkpoint on the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. But there is another side to the rugged city on the state's northwestern coast. Its artists find expression in the breathtaking but sometimes brutal environment. Joanne Swanson, wearing a blue-flowered cusbuck, looks comfortable sitting behind a table at the Nome Arts and Crafts Fair. The fair is located at St. Joseph's Church, only a short distance from the Iditarod Finishers Chute on Front Street. Swanson is a self-taught mixed media artist.
I am doing a mixed media acrylic floral art piece.
Swanson's busy dabbing paint on a new work while showing off her completed ones. She paints on a hard surface, not canvas.
They look like watercolor, but I'm using them like acrylic.
She points to a completed work, one of a musher driving dogs through falling snow. It looks like it was difficult to do.
Actually, yes, it was. I was missing my son at the time and wishing that he would just come home for Christmas. And it looked like, Iditarod. Yes, I think I'll do an Iditarod, a dog musher. Musher coming in, number one, surrounded by his family.
Swanson is one of many local carvers, craftsmen, skin sewers, and fine artists who packed into St. Joseph's Church for the annual Iditarod Finnish Arts Fair earlier this month. Swanson's colorful two-dimensional paintings gain her an inevitable comparison with New England artist Grandma Moses.
Oh, you know, a number of people have said that some of my art pieces look very folksy. And one thing she and I have in common is that we both started a little later in life.
Across the aisle, Frances Kakuna from Shishmaref sells sculptures carved from bones, tusks, or horns of all kinds. Some are 2 feet tall. Kakuna says he learned his skills from family members.
I used to carve when I was in the grade school, and at that time, like, the prices on the bracelets were like only $5 up there. That was back in the 60s. Yes.
Karen Olana carves too, although she expresses herself by making block prints, jewelry, and other crafts as well.
There's a lot of carving done here, traditional local materials, and it's inspiring to be among such good carvers.
Olana says she pretty much taught herself art skills with help from a few classes at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She says her Seward Peninsula environment influences her work more than anything else.
I think nature themes relating to nature is the strongest theme up here, how you relate to nature, where in the cities it seems to be artwork about alienation from nature. Whether you succeed in your relationship or not, it's a journey of how you relate to nature.
The three are only a few of the many artists displaying their work in Nome. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.